Liberty sees me, it stands by me, and celebrates me for who I am.
When I come into the office, I feel that I belong here.
I don't have to be corporate America Gabby. I can just bring Gabby to work.
Reach your potential and find a job you love at Liberty Mutual. We offer development training, rich benefits, and a culture that lets you bring your whole self to work so you can pursue your tomorrow today. Ready to consider a career at Liberty Mutual? Find out how at libertymutualcareers.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/TCJessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the crimes of Leonard Lake and Charles Noon, the serial killer duo who murdered families and kept the women prisoner in Northern California during the 1980s. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you would like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, leave a 5-star review, as well as share the show on social media. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content, and you'll get shout-outs when you sign up. Speaking of Patreon, I have to shout out my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. I also need to shout out Debbie from True Crime University, a fantastic true crime podcast, Samantha, and Robert, who came back last week at the start of this case. If you want to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. You can find me on most social media platforms under one of those monikers. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week discussing Leonard Lake's life. Particularly, we had gotten him to the point where he's living out in the middle of nowhere. He's starting to groom young women. And that's something that is often overlooked in this case, is that Lake had a predilection for young girls. Now, it's known that Lake would really try and get anyone that he fancied to pose for his photographs. One young woman whom he tried to entice to get pose for the camera later stated, quote, I was shocked to see girls no more than 10 or 12 years old, semi-nude. There was one picture of a young boy and girl, partially unclothed, hugging each other. Lake begins devoting more of his time to this, often taking the one-horned goat named Sir Lancelot to fairs in an attempt to meet young girls. There are some stories out there that during this period of time, people who lived on the ranch, which was the commune that Leonard Lake had forced his way into during the late 1970s, residents began noticing that power tools were missing, and that out in Ukiah and greater Mendocino County, a string of burglaries were reported where weapons, particularly rifles, dynamite, and ammunition, were noted to have been stolen. In the book, Die For Me, The Terrifying True Story of Charles Nguyen and Leonard Lake by Don Laster, he draws the conclusion that Lake may in fact have been responsible for these crimes. It's not outside the realm of possibility, as we know that given his job working with the Public Housing Authority, Lake had no qualms about stealing from that organization by over-ordering building supplies for the jobs that he was overseeing. Some point in the fall of 1980, Leonard Lake ends up taking Sir Lancelot to a Renaissance fair in Marin County. And it's at this fair that he meets a woman by the name of Clara Lynn Cricket Ballaz. And Cricket is someone who's going to play a key part in this entire saga. Very quickly, a relationship begins between the two, with Lake traveling to the San Francisco Bay Area almost weekly to see Cricket. It's been said that Cricket was a willing participant in Lake's various sexual fantasies, and that she brazenly posed for his camera. Despite having met this young woman, Lake continues his correspondence with Darlene Davis. According to Darlene, Lake would send letters containing photographs as well as discussions of his sexual escapades with Cricket, and all the while he's sending these messages, he's telling her that Cricket is jealous of her, but also that Cricket is looking for a female partner to share the bed with the two of them. This is more grooming on the part of Leonard Lake. Obviously, Darlene is pretty well under his spell at this point. She's not objecting to any of the things that he is sharing with her, even as the letters and pictures grow more and more explicit. On the home front, though, Lake is experiencing a series of problems. The residents of the ranch are getting fed up with the fact that Lake is growing marijuana on his property, which is prohibited by their bylaws, but even those who are growing marijuana on their own properties are beginning to distrust him, as Lake is stealing from them as well. And things start to come to a head when a shed on Lake's property catches fire, and the ammunition inside of it goes up in the blaze, leaving the residents to start to demand that Lake be forced out of the compound. They were aided in this, however, in the fact that Lake ends up getting caught stealing building materials at the housing works. Lake ends up being arrested and placed into jail, eventually receiving a year of probation. This led the members of the ranch to demand that Leonard Lake sell his property and leave, something which he reluctantly does. After leaving the ranch, Lake and Cricket, who by this point was pretty much living with Lake, went to the town of Philo, California, which is about 20 miles west of Ukiah. And he ends up getting a job at the local motel, where he and Cricket are gonna be able to live as well as work. With Cricket getting a job working as a teacher's aide at the local elementary school. And he quickly sets about ingraining himself into the community, joining the all-volunteer fire department, which he ends up putting a lot of his time and effort into. Lake ends up putting a personal ad in the Bay Guardian, which was a San Francisco free publication, wherein it basically states he's looking for someone to relocate to the town of Philo and help operate and maintain a small motel. Obviously, this is a ruse on the part of Leonard Lake. He is simply looking for another participant in his various sexual activities. He gets a letter from an 18-year-old by the name of Connie Richards, wherein she outlines all of the various skills that she possesses, and Lake, obviously liking the fact that a 18-year-old woman has contacted him, quickly sets up a meeting with Connie in Philo. Upon meeting them, she quickly learns that she will receive room and board in return for helping out with the duties at the motel, although Connie later stated that it very quickly became apparent that the entire reason for hiring her was the fact that Lake and Cricket wanted a sexual partner, and in her own words, it was more a partner for Cricket than it was for Lake himself. According to this young woman, the couple would tell her about their sex life, about their interest in bondage, and eventually she ends up joining the two of them. Although she did engage in activity with Lake on her own, which she stated was gentle and caring and completely with Cricket's consent. Again, according to Connie, Lake told her at one point that he had wanted to sleep with his sister Janet, that it was a fantasy. Well, we know that Lake did things to his sister, so this is implying this young woman trying to find out what she's comfortable with, that type of thing. She ends up posing for Lake, although not in his preferred method of full nudity. Instead, she poses topless. Lake is, of course, still in contact with Darlene, who he's filling in on all of the goings-on, particularly the sexual activities that he and Cricket are getting involved with their new partner, Connie. It's pretty obvious Lake is continuing to try and mold this young girl to his wishes, but he's also trying to make her jealous so that she will come back to him and they can resume their relationship. On September 13th, 1981, Lake and Cricket are married in Morgan Hill. Connie goes down there with them, where they interact with Charles Gunner, and Connie later stated that while there she met Lake's sister Janet, the one he had confessed to having had incestuous thoughts about, and that Gunner had propositioned her. When she told Lake about this, he basically said the man was a pervert. He had also attempted to proposition Cricket as well, before expounding on the fact that Gunner was abusive to his own wife, as well as his children, and that she shouldn't think any more about it. Lake also informed Connie that he had buried a good amount of silver in the area near Ukiah, which he was planning on using to purchase a home for the three of them. He further told her later on that he had moved the money to a house that Cricket owned in the Bay Area. This is more manipulation on the part of Leonard Lake. He's telling this young woman these stories, having this relationship with her, all in an effort to kind of bind her to him so that she will not want to leave and he can continue on with his perverse fantasies, dominating the young woman without her even really realizing that she is being controlled. And Connie ends up staying with the couple until shortly before Christmas of 1981. Very little happened during this period of time other than the things that I have outlined, with one major exception. Charles Ng arrived in the area during this period of time, and she described him as a short, unpleasant Asian man. How did Charles Ng get involved with Leonard Lake? Charles was a Marine who had gotten himself into some trouble, who came into Lake's life via a friend that Lake had met while down at the ranch. The individual was living in Hawaii when he encountered Charles, and using a post office box that Lake had, he contacted him to let him know that Charles was facing court-martial and was in serious trouble. So Lake arranged for Charles to travel up to Northern California, where, having surmised that Connie was getting ready to leave, Lake decided that Charles would be the perfect fit for them to fill the role that Connie had been filling in terms of a labor, not as a sexual partner for himself and Cricket. So who is Charles Ng? Ng Chatat was born December 24th, 1960 in British Hong Kong. He was the youngest of three children and the only boy. Now, some sources state that his father was a wealthy Hong Kong business executive. However, this is a misnomer, as the reason many thought that the Engs were wealthy was the fact that Charles's father owned an automobile, which during this point in time in China was an extreme luxury item, almost akin to owning a color television in the United States. The family had cramped living conditions, which is still fairly common in present-day China, as families do not allow other family members to go without things such as food and housing. So in addition to the Ungs, there was also the cousins as well as two grandparents that lived inside of the home that Charles was raised in. And according to family members, he was a fairly normal child who, although quiet, would go out of his way to try and do things for other members of his family. One of his sisters recalled that when they were little, when she would come home from school, her brother would always have snacks out waiting for her. Inside the home, the most important thing was education, and anything that might take away from an education was frowned upon, and in the case of Charles, disallowed. An example given by his family is the fact that Charles, early on, was attracted to Bruce Lee and the martial arts, and that his parents would not allow this to happen as they felt it would encourage their son to engage in fights with other boys, but it would also take away from his studies. Charles' father viewed Catholic schools at that point in time as giving the best education, and despite the fact that the family did not come from money, he was able to get his children into Catholic schools by basically pestering the heads of these various schools. You're probably wondering why this is such a big issue in Chinese culture. There are different types of schools, and for your child to be successful, it's felt that they need to go to a quote-unquote good school. In order to make sure that this happens, the parents would do anything that they could in order to get the schools to accept their children. It's not like here in the United States where schools have to accept the students that live in their area. In China, they can just say no. And while Charles's sisters worked diligently at their schoolwork, he himself was not interested in any of the expectations that his parents had for him. Because of this, the home life inside the Nung household could be dangerous at times, as Charles would often fail classes or outright.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Refused to do his assignments, and then, as is now, disciplining children in China could be fairly graphic. Charles's father later stated that he had no qualms with using a belt or a cane on his misbehaving son, and in fact, he blamed his son's actions on this harsh punishment. However, my counter to that is that kind of punishment was and still is very common within China. Why are not more individuals turning out like Charles Nung? I think the reason is that he was born different to begin with and may in fact have had some form of an inferiority complex going on with him, that he just used the beatings his father used to give him to give an excuse as to why he did the things that he did. The flip side of that, however, is statements given by family members of Charles, who said that at the time his schooling began, the young boy really began to withdraw from interacting with people. He mostly focused his attention on a sister and an older male cousin. Charles's mother, Wu Ping, has stated that it was her belief that other incidents in Charles's childhood had caused him to go astray, one being the pet chicken that Charles had been allowed to keep being turned into a family meal. Another incident involved a pet turtle that Charles had that the family eventually had to get rid of because he would not house the thing properly and instead allowed it to wander throughout the house making a mess. Things like this happened throughout Charles's early upbringing. As he progressed through school, it was noted that more and more often he would spend time in his bedroom reading and daydreaming. It's known that even before he got into high school, Charles was exhibiting some fairly disturbing behavior. He had a propensity to steal small, insignificant things from people around him, whether they were friends or family or individuals that he didn't know. It's known that around the age of 10, he was actually caught stealing a picture from a friend's house. While I can't verify all of this information, there is a reporter out there who did research into Charles Ng and stated that the petty thefts were the smallest of the crimes that Charles committed. He was known to seek the children of foreigners out in local parks in order to assault them, to throw Molotov cocktails from the roofs of buildings, as well as to do various acts of vandalism, many of which got him arrested and in trouble with the local police force. My counter to these claims is simply the fact that during this point in time, the 1960s, 1970s, China was under the control of their Communist Party, and actions such as this, even in a place like Hong Kong, which was under British rule, would have drawn the attention of the Chinese Communist Party and more likely than not resulted in some form of punishment for Charles's family. Because even though Britain ruled Hong Kong, there was still a very hardcore communist presence within the city. It's known that he was expelled from numerous schools due to behavioral issues as well as to not doing his schoolwork. He's eventually sent to a boarding school in Great Britain that his father arranged. However, this too proved to be futile, as Charles was caught stealing from other students and expelled from the school. The flip side of that comes from Charles's mother, who stated that her son informed her he did not felt that the uncle he was staying with in Britain wanted him there, and that she had gone to visit and found that he was being neglected, forced to sleep in a room with no heat, being given inadequate food, and that when she spoke to Charles's uncle, he informed her that Charles was no longer welcome in their house. As a result of this, Charles's mother ends up bringing Charles and his older sister Janet, who was also in Britain at a boarding school, back to Hong Kong with her. Charles' family ends up sending him to California in San Leandro, which is east of the San Francisco Bay, where he is enrolled at Notre Dame College. Charles travels there in 1979 on a student visa. His aunt would later state that he worked at various stores around where they live, commuted by bus, and that she eventually taught him how to drive a car. Although Charles, who was notoriously nearsighted, ended up selling a car that he later had purchased because every time he got behind the wheel, it seemed as though he was getting into some fender bender or another. Once school starts, Charles very quickly grows tired of the routine, and in October of 1979, without informing any of his family members, Charles joins the United States Marines in October of 1979. Now, during this period of time, non-citizens were not able to join the Marine Corps. However, records show that Charles's place of birth was listed as Bloomington, Indiana, and Charles stated to various individuals that his recruiting officer had actually helped him to falsify records so that he could go into the Marine Corps. Of his time in the military, it's stated that Charles took to it like a duck to water and very quickly ensconced himself in the whole idea of survivalism, something that was not and still is not uncommon for individuals serving in the United States military. Ends up being stationed in Hawaii, where it was noted that he had continued with his loner lifestyle, very often doing little more than staying at the barracks or on occasion going to see a movie. Many felt that he was an exemplary Marine, although he seemed to be extremely lonely and out of place among them. it was during this time, as he's in Hawaii, that Charles really begins to explore the idea of survivalism, and by chance ends up meeting an individual by the name of Mark, who also knew Leonard Lake. They met in a bookstore looking at books on survivalism. And because of this and the fact that both men avoided drinking, using drugs, chasing women, that sort of thing, they quickly developed a friendship, with Mark eventually telling Charles about his friend Leonard, who lived in Northern California. His friend Mark also made note of the fact that Ning seemed not interested in any way, shape, or form in having a relationship with a woman, something that at first he put off to being bisexuality, but eventually he came to realize that Charles felt massively inadequate and that there was no possible way that this young man would be able to have and build a relationship with a woman. And then things changed in Charles's life. In September of 1981, Charles ends up being assigned to guard duty at a facility that his company was in charge of, where they kept their weapons. And while he's standing on guard duty, Charles gets the idea that he could steal some of these weapons, keep some of them for himself, and sell the rest of them for a hefty profit. I think you can see where this is going. After checking out this area, Charles finds that there's a window that could very easily be opened with bolt cutters, and that this window is in fact hidden by bushes, and he begins to really contemplate how to go about this. And after stewing on the idea for a few weeks, he talks to another friend of his who's inside of their unit, and the friend agrees that this is a good idea, that they could make a lot of money from this. So, on October 10th, Charles goes and finds a friend of his who is going to be standing duty inside of this warehouse, and asks him if he would do anything to protect what is inside of the building. The friend responds that so long as Charles does not involve him in it, he will not do anything and he will not stand in his way. After going and talking with his confederate, Charles returns to this other individual who's standing duty by the name of Williamson, who Charles saw as weak-willed, and put the screws to him to try and get Williamson to go along with it. He still refused before Charles pulled out his trump card, letting him know that if he did not participate in this crime, he would inform Williamson's wife of an affair that he had had, as well as beat him up. Then, later that night, using William's car as a means to transport what they planned on taking, Charles and his confederate broke into the armory. Leaving the armory, they drove to another area on base where the weapons were stored inside of duffel bags and hidden inside heavy brush before returning the vehicle to where they had found it. This is all coming from Charles Nung, who said that after hiding the weapons, they returned to their barracks, where he woke a friend of his up who had helped him purchase an illegal handgun earlier and told him what he had done. His friend readily agreed to help get the weapons off base and to help sell them, and reached out to an individual that he knew who told the duo that he would help in exchange for a M203 grenade launcher. And it was set that the weapons would be placed inside of large PVC tubes in order to be transferred off of the base. After getting the weapons off base, they met with this other individual, and Ng ended up transferring the stolen weapons to this man after doing a inventory on them. And basically, at least according to Charles, he ends up getting ripped off for the weapons. They are never seen again. 3 days later, on October 12th, Charles ends up being arrested by the Naval Investigative Services for larceny, stealing government property, conspiracy to steal government property, and he very quickly flips on his Confederates, for, as he later stated, he knew at that moment that one of the individuals involved in this thing had given him up. In exchange for agreeing to flip on these men, the Marines inform Charles that he will receive a fairly short sentence of manual labor. On October 13th, Charles is interrogated at the NIS headquarters at First Light, where until 2:30 the next morning, wherein Charles Nguyen gives a complete confession of his involvement and the involvement of others in the theft of these weapons. So after this interrogation, Charles is brought to a squad bay where the escorts who are bringing him around are trying to arrange for transportation to bring Charles back to the brig. And according to Charles, he could tell that both of the men were tired and distracted. Quote, "I was interrogated by Special Agent Thomas LaFreniere until the early morning hours at the squad bay. One of the chasers was talking on the telephone and the other was sitting back smoking. I was allowed to freely wander about the office with very little security precautions being taken. I noticed that a rear window was open. I was very concerned that the information I'd given the agent might put me in danger with the syndicate because of those involved, and that my testimony would get Williamson into trouble, so I decided to escape through the window. While the chasers weren't paying attention, I went through the back window and ran across the field by Makapu School. I went directly to the residence of a corpsman friend of mine. He came to the door and asked me what I was doing. I told him that I'd been framed for the weapons theft and asked him to put me up for the night. He agreed and told me that he and his wife would take care of me as long as they could. I took a shower and went to sleep. The following morning, an agent of the NIS going through all of Charles's known friends and contacts reaches out to this individual by telephone, asking if he has seen Charles and letting him know that anyone who may be assisting in Charles's flight will be subject to court-martial and prosecution. After getting off the phone, this friend informs Charles that it is too dangerous for him and his family to stay there, and Charles is going to have to leave. So, furnishing him with civilian clothes, Charles is then stuffed into the trunk of this individual's car and driven out to an area known as Quarry Road, where Charles is preparing to camp out. That evening, his friend returns and informs him that the NIS has been all over base looking for Charles, distributing flyers with his face on it and offering a $500 reward. He requests that Charles turn himself in, which Ning obviously refuses to do. After this, his friend gives Charles $20, buys him some supplies at a nearby 7-Eleven, and drives Charles off base. Charles ends up hiding out in the wilderness of Hawaii for 2 days and eventually makes his way to a bus stop where he contacts his friend Mark. While hiding out at the barracks that Novak lives in, Charles contacts his parents, who send him $300, which he uses to buy clothing, a backpack, and a plane ticket to San Francisco. It's at this point that Novak puts him in contact with Leonard Lake. In early November of 1981, Charles Nguyen ends up at the airport, where he says that he hid out in a bathroom until it was time for his plane to depart, before landing in San Francisco, where he takes a bus to San Leandro, where he stays at his aunt's house. And while he's at this house, Charles himself reaches out to Leonard Lake, and arrangements are made for Charles to come up to Philo and stay with Leonard and Cricket. The two men quickly formed a bond over their shared military experience as well as their interest in survivalism. Charles ends up staying with Lake and Cricket for roughly 6 months. I was unable to find an exact date for what happens next, but at some point in the early to mid part of 1982, we're talking, you know, anywhere between February to May or June, the FBI learns of Charles Ng's whereabouts and stages a raid on the motel where Charles and Leonard Lake are staying. Some sources state that during the course of this raid, a large stash of weapons and explosives were found. In any event, Charles is arrested and sent back to Hawaii while Leonard Lake is arrested for harboring a federal fugitive. He ends up being bonded out of jail and then jumps bond, deciding to live his life on the run from the law. And this is kind of a turning point in all of the individuals involved's life. Charles ends up pleading guilty and serving 18 months in Leavenworth Prison in Kansas before he's eventually released. Leonard ends up going on the lam.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Financing himself through petty thefts and drug dealing, living with friends and staying in seedy motels. Whereas Cricket, seeing that things are not going to get better in her life with Leonard, decides that it would be best if she went back to the Bay Area and lived with her parents. No, she does tell her husband, look, I'll figure something out, but I'm not doing this. I'm not living the life of a fugitive with you. So over the course of the next few months, as Leonard's on the run from authorities, Cricket is meeting up with him at various places in order to engage in sexcapades. And eventually, she comes up with the idea that the perfect place for Leonard to hide out would be at a cabin that her father has purchased in Wileyville, California, which is in Calaveras County, California, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. But that's not everything that happened while Lake was on the road. It's known that he spent some time with his friend Gunnar, wife Vicky, and two children, and that at some point during this, Vicky informs Leonard that her husband is a rather strange sexual voyeur who wants his wife to go and have sex with other men, although he does not want to witness it. Instead, he wants her to come back and tell her of everything that happened. And according to Vicky, in later statements she gave to authorities, she had a one-time sexual encounter with Leonard Lake during this period, which she described as nondescript. Lake was also in constant contact with Darlene Davies, who, if you'll recall, is the underage girl that Leonard had been grooming from the age of around 13. And in his letters to Darlene during this period of time, he informs her of everything that has happened, admitting that he was quote-unquote not entirely innocent, and that Cricket, in fact, had been involved in these crimes, although he had shielded her from the police by taking all of the blame on himself. Darlene eventually agrees to meet with Leonard Lake, in July of 1982. During this meeting, which took place in Napa, he informs her that he's living in on a ranch in Northern California, and that Cricket had left him to go and engage in a bisexual relationship. He also informs Darlene that he can't stay in one place for too long, but she can continue to stay in contact with him, and he gives her an address to a friend of his, as well as an alias to mail these letters to, that of Ted White. After this, they have a sexual encounter, and according to Darlene, Lake then reaffirms his affection for her before leaving. She stated in the book, Die for Me, the Terrifying True Story of Charles Ng and Leonard Lake, that she did not see or hear from Leonard Lake for 2 years after this, in part because she became involved with a boy her own age, but also because Lake had gone into the cabin in Wileyville and was now actively pursuing living out his fantasy. Before that happens, Lake begins pursuing women that he'd had in sexual encounters with prior to the introduction of Cricket into his life, namely Gina and her friend. Gina stated that Lake just showed up there at their house one day and would continue to do this once every 3 or 4 months. And that they would feed him, engage in sexual intercourse with him, and he would leave. And it's from this that we learn that something has changed in Leonard Lake. He's having these sexual encounters with the two women. Now, according to Gina, during one of these visits, Lake again pressured her to pose for him, which she agreed to do, although she refused to disrobe. And upon her refusal, Leonard's face turned red and he began shaking violently before demanding that she remove her bra straps so he could at least retouch the pictures and make it appear as though she was nude. She acquiesced to this demand from Lake, but it gives us some idea as to what is going on in his mind. And what I mean by that is this. Many experts on serial killers discuss the fact that they usually start when they're young, although not always the case, and that once they start, they generally don't stop unless something happens in their life to force them to stop, whether it be changes in living situation, relationships, job, you name it. And that once they've stopped, they generally do not start back up again unless there is some major stressor in their life that forces them to go back into this life of murder. However, there are another type of serial killer who need that stressor in order to begin their killing spree, and who need that stressor in order to begin to seriously consider committing these acts, as well as planning them out in their minds. And Leonard Lake falls into this second category, wherein he was fine to talk about the various things that he talked about and to have the fantasies that he had, provided he had willing participants in his various escapades. Now that he is on the government's radar, he no longer has the stability of a home life. He does not have access to his normal willing participant. His mind begins to turn to other avenues of getting the same type of sexual gratification that he desires. And in this turning of his mind to it, it starts expounding on how he can carry these things out and remain undetected by both law enforcement and society at large. So during 1982-1983, Leonard Lake starts putting ads in newspapers, again, seeking female companionship. One of these individuals was a woman by the name of Rhonda, who immediately was put at ease by this older balding man, who, although he came back to her apartment with her that evening, did not pressure her for sex. They end up going to his friend Gunnar's house, where the two of them spend the night. And during this, Lake confesses his real name to her, that he'd been recently arrested, that he had been separated from his wife after she demanded that he do his time. And Rhonda stated that she felt the same way that Lake's unseen wife did, and suggested that he do his time, although Lake would flounder between agreeing with her and then disagreeing with her. He then informed Rhonda that he had thought about suicide, but had come to the realization that he would only do this if he first eliminated certain key people, one of whom was his friend Charles Gunnar, who he detested for not only being a quote-unquote pariah on society due to his disability, but also because of his Charles Gunnar's treatment of his wife and children, which, for some reason, Leonard Lake found reprehensible. After this, they end up having a sexual encounter before Lake takes Rhonda on a trip to Hawaii. After this trip, they continue to see one another, with Lake continuing to confide in Rhonda. Eventually, Lake informs Rhonda that he and Cricket are reconciling, however, he's not willing to end their relationship. And she informs Lake that she is open to a group marriage, so long as everyone is willing. After everyone met, at being Rhonda, Cricket, and Lake, for dinner, they end up going and spending time at the cabin in Wileyville, where they spent their time working on getting the cabin into a livable condition for Leonard Lake and eventually Cricket. And again, according to Rhonda, during this period of time that they were up in Wileyville, she witnessed Lake and Cricket arguing on a near continuous base, and it was because of this that she decided to end her relationship with Leonard Lake, as she saw something dark and unpleasant inside of these arguments. So, not too terribly long after they left the cabin, Rhonda ceases contact with Leonard Lake. As for Lake and Cricket, at this point, their marriage was collapsing, and she filed for divorce, with the divorce being finalized on November 30th of 1982. However, the fact that they're divorced does not mean that they no longer have any sort of relationship. They still carry on their various sexual encounters, and Cricket also puts Lake up in the cabin in Wileyville, which is where we are going to pick up next week. We are going to end the episode at this point, at the tail end of 1982, with Leonard Lake living in the cabin in Wileyville and Charles Ng living in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. I hope that you have enjoyed this episode. As always, the Deathcast is a co-production between Corpse Creek Publishing and Big Pond Podcasts. Till next time, stay morbid.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.